Tonight is anniversary night. The format of tonight's meeting will be a main speaker who will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our information break and the anniversary celebrants. Our main speaker tonight is Roy.
Thank you. Good evening, friends. I'm Roy. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Central Coast Koori Beginners. It's a spirituality meeting, and it's back in Sydney. It's an hour and a half on the central on the coast from Sydney. And if you haven't already guessed by the way I speak, I'm an Aboriginal Australian, and a sober one. And my sobriety date's the 31st of August 2002. And I'm very, very grateful that through this program and a loving God and my understanding, that I'm able to stand here in front of you people today and carry not my message, but God's message. A loving God of my understanding. For me, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I come from a big family. My mum had 8 kids. I've got 5 sisters and 2 brothers, and we were born on a reservation, a little reserve, and it was a little small community, and my mum pretty much was a single parent, and growing up, we used to have the stereos with the big records and then the smaller records, and we used to have Connie Francis and Patsy Cline and Tammy Wynette and Charlie Pride and all the family around drinking. And the grog was, it was a party. And there was a lot of laughter and there was a lot of fun and there was a lot of joking. And I remember as a kid growing up, I was thinking, I can't wait. I cannot wait to join that party. I can't wait when I'm old enough to have my first drink. And in actual fact, my sisters and I, we used to empty the bottles and we used to fill them up with water and we'd drink them and we'd make out we were drunk. So it was just a matter of time. So it was monkey see, monkey do. And I had my first drink at the age of 15. And there's 2 things I remember about that first drink. There was plenty of vomit. There was puke everywhere. And the second thing I remember was just laying on my back and everything was just spinning around. And the more it would spin, the more I'd vomit. And it made me violently ill. And you know what? I could not wait to back up and do it again. Could not wait. Because I don't know about you people, but growing up and coming from where I come from, I grew up with low self-esteem. I had no confidence. I felt less than, and I thought other people were better than me. So it was just a matter of time. But that all changed. And I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, this beautiful program, I heard the Clark Kent scenario, where this nerdy-looking guy finds a phone box, then all of a sudden he comes out in his cape and his suit and he's got all his superpowers. And that's how I felt when I found the booze. That's how I felt when I found a bottle shop or a RSL, we call them RSL clubs back home, or a pub. So it changed. Them feelings of uselessness, not fitting in, not good enough, that all went out the window. You know, and then for me it was a lot of fun in the beginning. You know, my mates were doing it and my friends were doing it and my family was doing it and I was fitting in. But then all of a sudden the fun went out of it. And then I ended up on the other side. You know, I ended up at courthouses. I ended up in front of magistrates. I ended up in the police stations and police cells. 2 days after I turned 18, I woke up in prison. And I said, how did I get here? Not once did I blame the alcohol. I blame the community where I come from. I blame the police. I blame the magistrate. I blame family. I blamed everybody else. And I didn't really take... I wasn't responsible for my own actions. And what happened was I was on a geographical, like a lot of other alcoholics, and I ended up in Sydney. And by this time, I'm absolutely hammered from this disease. Absolutely hammered. The fear set in. You know, I was fearful. I couldn't look people in the eye. You know, and I I remember I could put up with a hangover because I'd just lay in the lounge for a couple of days and just drink cold water. You know? But what I couldn't put up with in the end was the mental and emotional torment that come with this disease. I mean, walking down the street when, you know, 2 days after three or 4 days after a bender, walking down the street and then see one of my family members or one of the people, because our community, people, everybody knew everybody. And I'm walking down the street and I couldn't look people in the eyes, and then I'd see one of the mob or one of the family, and they say, "Oh, mate, should have seen you on Saturday night." And I couldn't even remember what I'd done. So an angel from this program, because if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're carrying the message of AA, then as far as I'm concerned, you're an angel. And I was 12-stepped by this guy in Sydney, and he knew I was an alkie. He looked at me and he said, "Roy, why don't you come to AA? And you're not allowed to cusp in this meeting, so I won't say what I said. But what I did say is, what the F is an AA meeting?" And he said, "Mate, it's where people go and they're having challenges, maybe with the drink or family or relationships." And I said, "It sounds good, but I'll just give it a miss." And he caught me coming off a bender, and I was ready. I was ready. And I said, "Mate, to shut you up, I'll come to that AA meeting." So he goes, and I walked into the AA meeting, and I sat down, and you're not going to believe it. I looked up, and I seen the Serenity Prayer, and the word God just jumped straight out at me. And I'm thinking, here we go. What did I get myself into here? You know, religious program, you know, a Bible in one end and a gun in the other, and you're going to force it down my throat. And that was my attitude. And I didn't get sober from my first meeting. I walked straight back out, pretty much. And I went back out and got on the booze. And I didn't need you people to tell me the longer I drink, the worse it become. And it did. So I come back in on the rooms on the 31st of August 2002 on the Central Coast, and that's when my journey started. I was told to sit up the front, take the cotton wool out of your ears, stick it in your mouth, listen to the similarities and not the differences, and you could hear something that could very well save your life. And I sat up the front, and no word of a lie, right from the first older sober member that got up, he said, it's a spiritual program based on spiritual principles. It's a loving God of your own understanding." And I was ready. I heard that. And straight away the shutters went down. And I was in. I had no more excuses. I couldn't use the God word as an excuse. What it's like today? Well, what can I say? Man, here I am in New York City, in a suit and a pink shirt. You know, and I feel like Marlena said, you look like $1 million, you know, and it's just money can't buy what I've got. But I had to work for it, you see. I didn't come in here and drink your coffee and eat your biscuits and sat my backside on there on the chair. But I did do that for a long time. But then all of a sudden my Uncle Jimmy and I got my matey Scotty from Philly, and my Uncle Jimmy, he said, pain is a down payment on your sobriety. And the more pain you've been through, the more chance of you getting this program. And I was in enough pain. And I walked up to this lady and I prayed, and God put this lady in my path. And I asked this lady, would she be my sponsor? And she said, "Roy, I've got a couple of questions. I want to ask you the main question first. I don't want the answer now. Call me tomorrow morning." I said, "What's the question?" She said, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober?" I said, "I can answer that now." She said, "No, you won't." So I've gone home and I've tossed and I turned, and all these scenarios are going through my head, because I'm an alkie, remember? If I say yes, it's work, and I don't like work, I can look at you, but I don't want to look at me. I'll do your inventory, but I don't want to do my inventory. And if I say no, it was continue to go mad, crazy, and eventually either pick up a drink, neck myself or someone else. So the next morning I called her at something like some godly hours, 6:30 or 6 o'clock or whatever, and she swore at me and she said, "What are you effing ringing me this early for?" And I said, I was pretty desperate, I said, "I've got the answer." And the answer's yes. And she said, "Well, okay, come to my place and we'll start the work." And I said, "Okay." And I went to her house. We sat down. She looked me in the eyes. And she said to me, she said, "Roy, how do you know you're an alcoholic?" I said, "What type of question's that?" I said, "I drink a lot of booze." She said, "So?" I said, "I go to AA." She said, "So?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And she said, "That's the answer that I'm looking for." She said, "Because I think one of your big problems, or your biggest problem, is that you think you know everything." And she was absolutely spot on. And she said, "Well, let's go to the doctor's opinion, shall we?" She said, "Not your opinion, not my opinion, the doctor's opinion as outlined in the big book." We go to the doctor's opinion, then I start to find out that I'm suffering with a disease, a spiritual malady. It affects my mind, body and my spirit. Then we go there and we're reading through the doctor's opinion. I find out that I have a mental obsession. I obsess. I'm obsessing for this thing, this alcohol. Until I give into that obsession and I have the first drink and it goes in my mouth and goes all over my body. All over. Not just here. All over my body. And I get the sense of ease and comfort that comes with the first drink. And the doctor describes it as a phenomenon of craving. In other words, I can't stop. Unlike my wife, who can have half a bottle of wine, then turn around and have a coffee, then bath the kids, do the chores, put their pajamas on, good night, love them, going to bed. Put half a bottle of wine in me and see what happens. Or anybody else in this room. And I started to learn about myself through that process. And she showed me patience, tolerance, kindness and love. Unconditional love. She told me the truth. Then I find out that my disease isn't in the bottle shop, it's not in the bar, it's not in the pub, it's not in the club. My disease centres in my mind. I went, "Oh, okay. I'm the problem, not the booze." So we started to go through the process of the steps, and it was hard work for this alcoholic. Hard work. I worked my backside off. But I was desperate. I was in enough pain to ask that lady to be my sponsor. You know, and she saved my life. I owe everything I've got today through to this program. I owe it to AA. AA's taken me all around the world. Last year or the year before, I'm speaking in front of 65,000 people. I went, "Oh my God, how did I end up here? How did I end up here?" And it's because I'm a messenger for a loving God of my understanding. The only purpose that I stand here today is to help the newcomer and the alcoholic that still suffers out there. That's why we started our little group. It's an Aboriginal group back home. And it's for the newcomers, our mob, to come in and be introduced to AA. Because a lot of our mob can't read. I could be their big book. And that needs to be taken into consideration. And I give back today. I give back where I can, when I can. It's taken It's taken me to Thailand and Bangkok, and I've been asked to go to Malaysia. I don't even know where some of these places are. You know, and all I am is an alcoholic. But I need to be humble. Because I've only got a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I've got to do this every day. The ego rebuilds overnight. See, my fear will tell me that I'm not good enough. My fear will tell me that someone else should be sharing their experience, strength and hope. But I've just got to put that aside and just say, you know what? I've been told all my life that I'll never amount to anything. I'll never be good enough for anything. But I don't listen to that no more. You know, when fear knocks on the door, I just let faith go over and answer it. You know, and I've got that all because of this program, this fellowship. I work with newcomers today. My sponsor said to me, Roy, the only reason why I'm walking you through this program of recovery that's outlined in the 164 pages of this big book is that you go out and you affect and you work with as many alcoholics as you can. And I do that today. Through the grace of a loving God and my understanding. The three sides of the triangle, unity, service and recovery. Where am I? What am I doing? You know, I've got my family here today. You know, and it hasn't been easy. I was just talking to one of my other mates who I was sad to hear that his mum passed away and year before. My dad, I got a phone call and they said, Roy, you need to come to Sydney, RPA. There's someone that we've got in the morgue and you have to come down and identify this person, ID this person. And I went down and they brought out the trolley and they pulled back the sheet and it was my dad. And I, first and foremost, I was in shock. Then I said, when? What's happened? When? And they said, Roy, he's been here for 8 days. I said, you're telling me, it was a shock of losing my dad, but then turn around and saying that he's been in this morgue for 8 days and we didn't know? And if I didn't have this program or this fellowship, I can't handle that stuff out there. That's the stuff I drink over. That stuff would have kept me drunk for days and weeks and months. Just because I put the cork in the bottle doesn't necessarily mean that life's going to work out fine for me. You know, like I said before, I've got a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. 3, maybe 4 weeks ago, my sister's boy was in a chase with the police. He was 34 years old, had a car accident, and he passed away. And I had to go and support my sister. She buried this boy that she named after me. His middle name was named after me. And I was able to be there for her and be there for the family. This is real life stuff. This is what happens. You know, I was restless, irritable and discontented for so many years, a long time, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, even in AA, until I'd done the work. On page 133 of the big book, it says you can be happy, joyous and free. And man, I'm experiencing that. You know, I've got little kids today. I've got my son sitting up the front here with me today. You know, he's a podiatrist, he's a foot doctor. He's one of 5 Aboriginal foot doctors in the country of Australia. How blessed am I? Last year in December, I went and watched my daughter be accepted to the bar as a lawyer. She's a lawyer? Man, this stuff's crazy. And me, my ego's kicking in and saying, oh, that's because of me. Might have something to do with her mother. You know, so she's an Aboriginal lawyer back home in her country. And my colleague and I, who's with me tonight as well, we flew over here and we flew business class, and my son flew economy, so he's not going to let me live it down, but how good is it? Nothing but the best. And I suppose if I wanted to put it in, use it as a metaphor or in context, I come into AA, and I was happy to sit in economy, because I was on the plane, and look, it was really uncomfortable, you know, not a lot of room to move, and the food wasn't crash hot, and when you're traveling 14 hours on a plane to get here, then another six from LA to here, four from LA to here, so that's 18 hours on a plane. You want to be a little bit comfortable. So I'm happy to sit in economy when I first come into AA. Then all of a sudden I've seen them 12 things on the wall. And I've got to reference this guy. Bob D and Scotty come out, Scotty from Philly come out to a meeting in Seven Hills. Scotty jumps up and he had the baseball cap on back to front, and he stands there and he says, you know guys, he said, I done everything I was told in Alcoholics Anonymous except 12 things. And I said, this guy's talking to me. So I find a sponsor and I work the steps. And one of the things my sponsor said to me, he said, Roy, do you believe in a higher power? I said, absolutely yes. She said, have you accessed that power? Ah. I said, okay. Righto, how do we do that? Because I heard at a meeting one night that you can write a recipe, you can read a recipe book and die of starvation. And you can read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can read the big book of AA and die of alcoholism if you don't put the action in. Not you, me. So, I get through the 12 steps and I make my amends and, I get down to the 12th, and then all of a sudden, by this time, I've accessed this power greater than myself, and I end up in business class, and I'm thinking, wow, how long's this been here for? Lay in the lounge back, getting pajamas with a big kangaroo on them, silver cutlery. You know, the works and the perks. And I'm an alcoholic. I want the best, yeah? I didn't get sober. Half measures avail me nothing. I didn't get sober to take the second best. I got sober for the best. So then I realised that I've been in economy all this time, just coming to AA and not doing anything about them 12 things on the wall, when all I had to do was do them 12 things on the wall, then I could end up with this life that I have today. I shouldn't have waited all them years. And I love it. You know, God's given me a second chance at raising a family. I've got my little kids here. I've got my wife. You know, I flew them over. We're at the UN. United Nations. This drunk's at the United Nations. Can you believe it? And I cannot get enough of it. I've got to thank the group. I really have to thank the group for giving me an opportunity to share my experience, strength and hope. But the work's not over. I've got plenty of work in front of me. Because them stories that I shared earlier about my dad and my nephew, you know, they're dying younger and younger through this disease. And I have to try to be out there and help as many people as I can. And I just want to close with this poem. Some of you may have heard of it, some of you may not. But I was in a meeting one day, and it was death by PowerPoint, and I just started doodling. And then about 3 or 4 minutes later, I looked down and here's this poem in front of me. And I went, wow. And I'm not a poet. Nowhere near it. And the poem's titled, If You Have a Dream, You Have a Vision. And it goes like this. If you have a dream and a vision, Make it real, make it a mission. You'll have your ups and your downs, but don't let it knock you around. If you believe it's possible, then fight and tussle to allow it to be colossal. You may have to be bold and mean if you believe in this dream. You may have fear whispering in your ear, but tell it to go away, because you're not wanted here. For I found my place in this earth. It is my role to inspire you to challenge your self-worth. So go on your way and move towards your mission. And don't let anyone stop you from achieving your vision. For it is God who will be our final judge. For it is He who holds no grudge. So take the first step, as hard as it may be. It starts today with no more delays. For delays and excuses are for those that are leaners. But that does not include you, because you are all dreamers. Thank you very much, and God bless.